Would you come to order?
Yeah.
And the quorum having just arrived in the room, Representative Tice, have you had a chance to look at the minutes? And Representative Tice is giving us cookies this morning, I think.
I am, Madam Chair. My husband bakes them, and then he sends them with me. And it's Wednesday. I need to get rid of them. Or I will eat them all, so have your chase. Sure, I move the minutes.
Representative Tice moves the minutes of February 6th. Any changes or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Those minutes are approved. In this cold, snowy winter, I do always feel really apologetic about the 8 a.m. meeting, but thank you all for being here. And we'll dive right in. We have, as you can see, a very full agenda. And I'll be watching the time and sort of trying to keep people on task and time for this. In the first few meetings, this issue was raised. I think there's a concern. We certainly want affordable housing, and this is one piece that some people observe. And so we thought we'd take an early look at this. And we're looking at it this morning from a variety of perspectives. So I'm hoping it's just a learning experience as we hear different points of view. And we'd ask Scott McClellan to come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry and a state building official. Thank you for the opportunity this morning to provide some background information.
And members, in your packet you have a number of things. You have two items for this presentation the one is tucked inside the other, right? The technical advisory group, that piece is tucked inside the book. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, once again, I did provide you with this publication, Minnesota Guide to the State Building Code. It's something we've used to introduce other government officials and casual users to the code as to just what is the code, where does it come from, what's the purpose, what are the benefits, try to answer some of those questions. And so this morning I thought for the few minutes I have, it might be helpful to answer some specific questions for you that might further assist you in your facing the challenges of affordable housing. First off, I'd like to clarify just what is the code. Often it's referred to in generic terms. And the code is actually a compilation of a number of documents. And you can see that on the cover of the publication that you have. It consists of the elevator code, accessibility, floodproofing, the commercial building code, residential building code, plumbing, electrical, a number of separate documents. Together, the statute refers to that as the code. So just to clarify that. In fact, in the back half of the document, you don't have to search it now, there's a fact sheet for every one of the codes that actually describes what it covers, where you can obtain it, how it's developed, what it looks like. So, but for the remaining few minutes I have with you, I'd like to just answer a few questions for you. I'll kind of just walk you through some of the pages here. If you grab the green tab, please, and open up the page to legislative intent, I'd like to begin by answering the question, so why did the legislature in 1971 decide we needed a statewide building code? And frankly, the simple answer that's identified here in this preamble is to minimize regulatory costs. And I just want to briefly read that highlighted text that actually appeared in the statute, which is highly irregular by today's standards, but it's curiously similar to what we see today. Where it says, many citizens of the state are unable to secure adequate housing at prices or rentals which they can afford. Such a situation is contrary to the public interest and threatens the health, safety, welfare, comfort, and security of the people of the state. Other persons in commerce and industry are also affected by the high cost of construction. Construction costs for buildings of all types have risen and are continuing to rise at unprecedented rates. So it's just ironic that 48 years ago, the legislature was wrestling with the same issue, and one of the main reasons at the time was every city had their own code. And so builders and architects had to determine how to design and build to that particular city, and oftentimes they'd get caught because they didn't pick something up, ending up overcharging the owners for the building. So there's a little bit of perspective on the legislative side of where the code came from. The next question I'd like on the facing page to address is, so what's the purpose of the code? What's it supposed to look like? Is it intended to protect the public against all hazards in buildings or something less than that? So again, in statute, in the highlighted text I gave you, is out of current statute, and it's almost verbatim the way it was in 1971. I just wanted to draw your attention to some of the terminology. It says the commissioner shall amend and administer a state code which will provide basic, uniform performance standards and establish reasonable safeguards for health, safety, welfare, etc. And then surprisingly, it goes on to say, which will in part tend to lower construction costs. The construction of buildings should be permitted at the least possible cost consistent with recognized standards of health and safety. This is not a surprise to our agency. We've been addressing costs since the inception of the code. It's always been a degree of hazard, balancing that with the cost of mitigating the hazard. And that's what we try to do whenever we're looking at new codes and new requirements. Technology exists to provide a high degree of safety, but with that comes a cost. And so that's our responsibility, is to try to address that. So that addresses why do we have it and what's it supposed to look like. Basic, reasonable, uniform. If you'd please turn to the yellow tab, skip a few pages here. I'd like to address the question, so what do Minnesotans get when we adopt a code? The answer is society benefits in a number of ways. I've listed 16 of them here under benefits. And number one, of course, is safety and health. And hopefully that goes without saying. Most of us, when we walk into a building, don't think whether the roof's going to collapse from the snow or something else. But we just have that peace of mind. And yet, as an example, in 2015, when the roof of a water park collapsed in a non-code area of the state, although nobody was hurt, thankfully, that peace of mind is shattered. All of a sudden, it's like, that could happen here. Where else could it happen? But some of the other things that I've highlighted here are also equally important. Provides accessible buildings for persons with disabilities, provides energy-efficient buildings, buildings resilient to weather extremes, reduce property loss, verification work is done by licensed building contractors, and a number of other just as valid reasons that society has determined are very important that you can read as well. So that's what we get. Next question I'd like to address is on the facing page is, where do the codes come from? And the short answer is they come from Minnesota rules, of which you authorized our department to adopt, and they come from you, the legislature. And these are the two legal means for incorporating building regulations in the state. Now, because adopting or writing codes is just an incredibly complex undertaking, most jurisdictions throughout the country adopt a code that we call model codes. Their model codes are put together by an organization that represents government, industry, and the regulated architects, home builders, and they come up with this document that's easily adoptable by cities, states, counties, townships, but it has no standing. They publish them, they put them out there, and hope people will adopt them and buy them. And that's what Minnesota has done in the 40 years since we've had a code. The current model that's out there is the International Code Series. So we adopt codes through the administrative rule process as an agency. Sometimes when we evaluate these model codes, we find something doesn't fit that basic, uniform, reasonableness that's in statute, and we will change it. We will change it as an amendment to suit Minnesota. The other group, the legislature, can also change the code, which they've often done more on a strategic basis. And you can see some of the examples at the bottom of that page. Bleacher safety, window fall protection were implemented by the legislature when there was a series of fatalities and injuries. The legislature is able to act more quickly than the agency can to enact some of these safeguards. So these are some of the examples over the years that the legislature has introduced into the code. And then we actually put it into the code once we're into rulemaking. On the next page, I'll answer the question, where does the code apply and where is it enforced? The answer is the code applies throughout the entire state of Minnesota. That was a legislative change in 2008. No matter where you are, no matter who you are, if you're building a structure regulated by the building code, you must comply with the code. Enforcement is another matter. The code is only enforced in about half of Minnesota's cities, 61 townships, 21 counties, where the code at large is actually enforced by a certified building official. The exception to that is electrical, elevator, accessibility for the disabled, and commercial plumbing. Those areas have separate statutory authority to say they do apply statewide, and there are separate programs for enforcing those parts of the code everywhere. But the general building code, energy code, some of these others are only enforced in the cities that you see highlighted in the document. And then my last two questions I just wanted to address, and they you can refer to the handouts in the back of your booklet. First one is, who decides for Minnesota if the codes are appropriate? Okay, we've got these model codes out there. The agency's adopting it. Is the agency making all these decisions, or whom else? Well, we have a statutory advisory board, or council actually, called the Construction Codes Advisory Council. It's made up of 18 different industry representatives, architects, engineers, home builders, League of Cities, etc. And their charge is to evaluate codes, make sure there's no overlap, that they make sense, they're readable. And they employ advisory groups. In fact, they designated 10 of them this past year to study the new codes for adoption. Call them technical advisory groups. And you have the list of participants in front of you on the technical advisory group page. And the focus of today's meeting, obviously, is residential. So you can say in the center, see in the center of the page, the department staffs, all of these technical advisory groups. We also have a municipal building official. We have a residential home building industry, both the state organization and the Twin Cities organization. Plus, we identified an affordable housing advocate. And these folks helped us sift through all of the changes in the new code to put eyes on them, see if they're appropriate in Minnesota. They then made their recommendation to the full council, who then sent it out broadly to all of our stakeholders. If it were the residential, they sent it to everyone that's ever contacted us showing interest in the residential code for their public input. And this is before we even get to the Administrative Procedures Act. We're just really trying to make sure everybody that's affected is aware of what we're trying to accomplish. And then those comments came back, and they went to our commissioner, who then directed the agency after reviewing the comments and said, begin rulemaking. And that's what we're presently doing, to adopt a new series of codes. Lastly, I'd like to just address the costs surrounding the residential building code specifically. So there's a fact sheet I have there before you, too. I just wanted to say three things about this. First, our department has always considered costs when evaluating new codes. For two reasons. One, our statute charges us to do it. That's what we do. Number two, the Administrative Procedures Act goes into great detail as to how we have to substantiate codes and whether there's a cost impact on those affected by the codes. Second, there is a misconception out there that the new codes produce additional regulations every time we adopt a new series. Sometimes that's true, and sometimes we discover things such as with the Bleacher Act and some of these other things. Codes need to be improved. But more often than not, what the codes are doing, they're bringing clarity to existing requirements, some exceptions in helping folks understand it better. Because as you know, if you've ever worked with codes or building inspectors, it's always there's interpretive issues and some subjectivity involved. So the codes are constantly trying to be refined to bring clarity to that. And in fact, on this fact sheet that I've got there, I've listed 10 bullets of things we actually changed in the code the last time we adopted it to relax things and make things more suitable to some of the issues we've been facing. We've relaxed the model code and actually tried to incorporate some of those changes. And the last thing I wanted to clarify is that the department did not initiate some of those code requirements that are most often cited as being responsible for increasing costs. As I said earlier, both the agency and the legislature add to the code, change the code, and et cetera. But window fall, radon mitigation, and building durability, just to be clear, were passed by the 2009 legislature. Then eventually we put them into the code to address the wishes of the legislature as well. But they were driven by legislation that was passed, again, due to some very important issues and safety issues. So I'm not disputing that. I just want to make it clear. It wasn't the agency's idea that we needed to address these particular items. And the other controversial area that we often talk about when it comes to affordability is the energy code. And as you probably have heard, in the series of the 2015 codes, we did adopt a new energy code, which was 30% more restrictive than any of the previous codes we had adopted. And again, we were directed by an agreement that the governor signed with the U.S. Department of Energy in 2009 that we would adopt this restrictive energy code if Minnesota wanted to see support funding from the American Recovery and Renewal Act of 2009. So I could talk all day on this, but I will close it. Madam Chair, members, that concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Representative Pice.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I just have a couple comments coming from the business. I think one of the bigger problems is that code enforcement is not enforced across the state. And that is a huge problem for licensed builders who have to, you know, totally embrace all the changes and the amounts that come with it. The last heating code, and this comes from a gentleman that I know who works with HVAC, added another $7,000 to the cost of the home, and most of that was not included in appraisals. That's just following the code. And that is really a hard pill to bite for a contractor, no matter if you're in heating or in construction. The energy code is always kind of, I guess, a little bit unnerving for me because Minnesota already does a great job. And when we get some of these codes, we're already above it. And so we're adding above and above, which is really cumbersome. And in fact, I would say, listening from a lot of the folks that we have on the job, is that that's probably why we have a mold issue. Houses are so tight. They can't breathe, and houses need to breathe. So now we have to do the air exchangers and things like that. But I would say that if we really look at what makes a lot of sense and probably not look at, you know, what sounds really good to do, even though we are doing better, we would save a lot of money. When you talk about the code book is like, what, 3+ inches thick? And my guys have to carry that on the job site. And it's really a lot to take in, considering it wasn't even, what, a third of it when we first started? We started the company in 1985, and it has just changed incredibly. And I realize some of these codes are needed, but I think a lot of them are a little bit more than what Minnesota needs because we do a great job already. Last year, I carried the townhome bill to put townhomes back into residential rather than commercial because we were losing those things. And it wasn't necessarily a nationwide thing. It was a Minnesota thing to put it in. And I would caution us sometimes to think it sounds like a good idea when it isn't. I know it's a big controversy with sprinklers, but when you're talking about affordable housing, we need to look at what's more important then. And I think we really need to keep that in mind when we go through some of these codes. And I could go on forever, too. The last code, now you've got a sheetrock lids. You've got a sheetrock unfinished basements and crawl space areas. And when a person wants to remodel or finish that basement, that's all got to come down now in order to do it. And I understand the philosophy behind it. But in actuality, it is a burden, and it is a cost adder. And I think we really need to look at those things. Affordable housing isn't just one thing. It's a lot of things. I mean, I don't want you to feel like I'm beating up on you. I'm just telling you what our experience was. And when we look at affordable housing, we all have to have a stake in it, and we need to be realistic about what we really want to see happen and what is possible and what we can still put people in homes for. So I appreciate the work that you do and look forward to working with you in the future.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you.
We have, I would just caution you that we've already used more time for this, so please, if you can, Representative Munson, if you have a question.
I do have a question, Madam Chair, and it's pretty brief. You had mentioned the ADA, or the accessibility code, is enforced statewide. Is that true? Is that for, like, a commercial seed corn dealer in rural Minnesota has to have handicap accessible ramps and such to the building?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is true. I just want to clarify that the Americans with Disabilities Act is a federal civil rights protection, and there are guidelines for construction, but we enforce the Minnesota Accessibility Code statewide, or it does apply statewide, and it incorporates the Americans with Disabilities Act provisions. So in greater Minnesota, that has to be done by either the county or the city where that building is located in, and that effectively applies to all commercial-type buildings other than a single-family house.
Yep. And then just a follow-up question, Madam Chair. The one-fourth of the counties that do enforce the building code, what happens when a county adopts enforcement of that code? Can they retroactively go back and make changes to a house that was built, say, today, if the county adopts it next year?
Mr. McClellan.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, they cannot. That's all established, and it's only going forward looking at remodelings and new buildings.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We're going to hear now from perspectives. Thank you very much for, and I think the materials you're leaving us will be good reference for us.
Wonderful. Thank you.
So if I could have all three of the people testifying on the perspectives of cities, if we could just have all three of them at the table. I think we'll hear from all three before we will entertain any questions. We have the League of Minnesota Cities, City of Cambridge, City of Hugo. We're delighted you're all here. And we're starting with welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Irene Gao. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We're going to try to keep it brief because we do know that you have a number of testifiers here today. Just for those of you who don't know, the League of Minnesota Cities is a membership organization for cities. The members include 833 of the 853 cities in the state. The League provides a number of different services, including education, risk management, and advocacy. We're going to provide a high-level overview of when it comes to local regulations and fees. There are going to be nuances that hopefully will be answered through questions. With me today, as the chair had mentioned, we have two representatives from two different cities, one in greater Minnesota and one in the metro area, who are going to walk through their experiences and fill out some of the comments that I'm not able to get to.
And there is a handout in your packets from the
Yes, there are two handouts. There's one, city roles and housing, and the other one is development and cities Q&A. So housing is a critical issue for cities in Minnesota. There are unique dynamics in the 853 communities that you represent. Sometimes the housing needs are addressed through affordable housing, workforce housing, or market rate housing. And where you build matters. Sometimes we have different soils on which you build. Maybe it's sand, maybe it's clay, as well as maybe it's proximity to one of our over 10,000 lakes. It could be stormwater, and so we're concerned about the impact on our drinking water. Each community meets housing in a number of different ways. And so some of them would be adjustments to zoning. So, for example, smaller lot sizes or greater density to address more affordable housing. Or financial incentives, such as tax abatements. What's frustrating in these communities is despite these incentives or changes to zoning, sometimes we still don't see the development coming to these communities. Or sometimes we don't see actually cheaper homes being built or sold. Now, when development does occur, cities work with developers to ensure that they are safe and consistent with these community goals. Some cities have chosen to bear some of the development-related costs, and that's through taxpayer dollars. Some communities have chosen to have development pay for development. So we're talking about water, sewer, roads that are related to the development. Now, there are different buckets when we're talking about these fees. One of the buckets is development-related fees that goes to review, approval, and inspection of the development. And there are statutory limits to these fees. They have to be fair, reasonable, and have a nexus or a connection to the actual cost for the service for which the fee is being provided. And they have to be roughly proportional to the size and proposed use of the development. Now, with these types of fees, sometimes they're put into escrow. And as you know, how escrow works is we'll draw down on it for things like plan review. But if there's any money that's still left in escrow, that is returned to the developer. There are other fees that are related to infrastructure, so like water and sewer. And this is something that home buyers tend to want. There are communities that don't have water and sewer, but we have found that that is something that's desirable by home buyers. Now, if these fees are not paid by development, then what happens is it has to be paid by the taxpayers, either through greater taxes or sometimes if a city finds we can't raise taxes anymore, our residents can't take it anymore, then the development has to be halted, and that's not something that our cities want. One question that comes up is why are the regulations and fees varied from city to city? I'd mentioned some of those. Some of it has to be with a particular community, what kind of land there is, what relationship there is to water, but also because there's different planning and visioning goals for each community, which is tailored to the unique attributes of that community. For example, one city might really value the preservation of agricultural space, and another might value affordable housing. So you're going to see different plans for each city. With that, I do want to turn it over to Ms. Rivera and Ms. Wolf to talk about their experiences in their city.
And Ms. Wolf, are you going first?
I am going first.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Greetings, Madam Chair and committee members, and Representative Johnson, shout out. He's our local rep. My name is Linda Wolf, and I am the city administrator for the city of Cambridge. I have served the city of Cambridge for 12 years, and I have been in local government for over 25 years. Cambridge is a growing community just outside the seven-county metro area with a population of 8,803 people. We serve as the county seat for Isani County. We have 3,353 housing units with approximately 50 new single-family home permits pulled and built each year. Our city has been working very proactively on housing. For example, within the last 3 years, the city has focused on increasing our supply of workforce housing. By working with developers through a variety of financial incentives, including tax increment financing and the forgiveness of special assessment spending on tax forfeited land, we have added both single and a multifamily lot for a wide range of incomes. Because of our community's positive approach to development, developers frequently work again in Cambridge once their projects are finished. We have a very long-standing relationship with several developers, such as Metro Plains, and Metro Plains works greatly with the Greater Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. How do large-scale projects move forward in Cambridge? The city works with the developer and is statutorily required to approve the development within 60 days. With undeveloped land, when large acreage is platted, the city works with the developer to determine the best layout for water and sanitary sewer infrastructure, not only for this development, but any future developments that may come afterwards. If any increase in pipe size is needed, or the pipes need to be buried deeper to preserve the proper incline for gravity flow of the sewage, the city participates in the cost of upsizing or burying them deeper. The development is only charged for what is attributable to that development. It is the City of Cambridge's policy to have new development pay for the costs of new infrastructure, and then the monthly utility bills that are paid by all users cover annual operating costs such as water treatment, sewage treatment, storm pond maintenance, and system upkeep and replacement. Because we all know once they go in, you have to maintain them, and eventually you have to replace them. After the plat is approved, then the building process begins. The builder applies for a building permit, and the building's review process begins. The city is able to complete that review process within 7 to 10 days. At the time of the building permit application, each structure is charged for its connection to the water and sanitary sewer system. A single-family home is charged $1,102 for a water connection and $2,273 for the sewer connection. These fees are put into a dedicated enterprise fund for sewer and water infrastructure replacement. These funds are never commingled with our general fund. As part of the city's building permit review process, we conduct an impervious surface calculation. Impervious surface is land that is covered by driveway, structure, or any other hard surface that won't absorb rainwater. Because Cambridge is classified by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency as an MS4 city, we are required to properly manage and cleanse stormwater runoff. One of the ways this is done is by limiting the amount of impervious surface on lots to allow for proper on-site stormwater retention and cleansing. This is important because the sandy soils in Isani County have been identified as a major recharge area for both the Mount Simon and Hinckley aquifers. These aquifers serve as a major source of drinking water for communities from north central to southern metro areas of Minnesota. Our city works with developers to vary lot sizes as well as house sizes so their final product can meet the needs of a wide variety of home buyers. We do not force a cookie-cutter approach. For example, our Parkwood on the Lakes development is a planned unit development that has small, medium, and large lot sizes, and it contains not only starter homes, but executive-style homes as well. The final development fee the city collects is a park dedication fee. In order to be an attractive community where families and people of all ages will want to locate in, we must have some park amenities. Developers have the option of paying the park dedication fee or installing a park within their development. The fee is collected at the time the larger acreage is platted. If the developer decides to dedicate land for the park, the city then in turn will pay for the cost of improving the park. Park dedication fees are saved in a dedicated account and are not commingled with the general fund. We frequently have park and trail projects that require significant capital investment, and we save our park dedication funds from year to year until we can pay for them in cash. Therefore, it can appear that one year we will collect more fees and have fewer expenses. What is happening is the capital expenditures occurs when the park dedication fees are enough. And again, we pay cash, which is cash is king. Development is a community's vital lifeblood, and where you develop matters. Cambridge is a freestanding community that does not have the benefit of spreading its sewer and water costs across the 7-county metro area. We only have a few thousand users. Development needs to pay its own way so that we don't overburden our existing sewer and water customers with the cost of new infrastructure and new development. Smart development finds a way to balance infrastructure investment, housing stock, employment opportunities, and community amenities. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions of me, I would be pleased to do my best to answer them for you.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. We'll hear from Mr. Baer, and then we do have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Appreciate the time. Brian Baer from the city of Hugo. Hugo is a city that is in the metro area in the Northeast Metro. We're about 15,000. And Linda did a really good job explaining the process, so I'll just dive into a couple of those topics a little more deeply. What I'd like to start off with is by suggesting that the development process as it plays out, in my view, only works if there's a good partnership between the development community and the city. This is a process that we're both very involved in. We're joined at the hip from start to finish. If we're not getting along, the product probably isn't going to be right. Not every developer, not every city make a good match. And sometimes developer can't figure out a way to make the product work in that city, and that's okay. Another developer might be able to make it work on that same piece of property with a different project. What the city wants in this partnership is a great neighborhood, right? We want comfortable, clean, safe neighborhoods that are attractive and well-designed. The developer wants that too. Developer needs to make a profit at the same time as putting those things together. We get that, and that's part of the partnership. So how do we make this work, right? There's a couple of levers that I just want to talk to you about that the city can pull on and can maybe help or hinder the success of a project. There are some other levers that we don't control very well. that may have a bigger influence on the price of a house and some of the things that a city can do. So one of the levers that we can't control, at least in the metro area, is the decision about whether to grow or not. The Met Council makes that decision for us. So in the metro area, that decision is removed from metro cities, and then we deal with, well, if we're one of those cities that is charged with growth, then we create the plans and the ordinances to manage that growth as directed, right? So it's important to keep that in mind. So we are managing growth with some instructions. One of the levers that we can pull on as a city is we can collect fees. Linda talked a little bit about fees, and let me give you an example. The city of Hugo is going to build a water tower this year. It's a $4 million project. The city doesn't need a water tower if it just remains the way that it is, right? But the city is going to grow. We know that. That's a given. So we need to have a water tower to accommodate that growth. The taxpayers don't want to pay for that water tower. They don't need it. So the city creates a structure that collects a fee. So there's a fee that's collected every time a house is built, and that, as Linda pointed out, will go into a pot of money that allows for development of infrastructure like a water tower. We have the same thing for sewer systems. With every development, we build sewer pipes, water systems, public streets, and stormwater drainage infrastructure. That partnership results in the developer constructing these improvements and the city accepting them when they meet our standards. The next thing that the city can really pull on a lever with is regulation. We create our codes and ordinances, and that creates standards for which development would typically need to follow. That is something that we can manage as a city. We can work flexibility into our ordinances. A great example of this is lot size. Okay, a developer is interested sometimes in reducing the lot width of a particular lot. The more lots that they can fit on the same segment of street helps them lower the development cost per lot. You have the same amount of infrastructure but potentially more lots on that street. So if we can make the lots skinnier, that helps them create those lots. So the city can create some flexibility in our ordinance. The code might say that the lot has to be 80 feet wide, but then through a process the city will introduce flexibility into our code that allows that lot width to be reduced to 70 or 65 or 55, or in Hugo some of our lots are 45 feet wide. Okay, the next thing that we can talk about is when you make the lots too skinny, you fill up the lot with house, and then you might get a request for flexibility from setbacks. How close is the house to the property line? Well, we can reduce those from 20 feet between houses to 15 feet between houses to 10 feet between houses. Pretty soon they get pretty close. 10 feet between wall to wall on a house means the overhangs are almost touching. We've got some of those in Hugo. We introduce flexibility into the code. The problem with adjusting fees and with adjusting regulations in this way, creating some flexibility, is we don't think that that lowers the cost of the house. Hugo is a city that has relatively low fees. We're a very low-fee city in our view compared to other cities. But the cost of housing in Hugo is the same as the housing in our neighboring cities. So the same house in Lino Lakes or Centerville, that cities right next door to Hugo, can be purchased for the same price. It doesn't matter what the building permit fee is or the development fee. The market determines what the cost of the house is, right? If a buyer is going to pay $450,000 for a house and Hugo lowers its building permit fee, guess what the price of the house is in Hugo? It's $450,000. Okay? That money gets paid through the transaction. There's a few transactions in this process where that can occur, and the city doesn't have a lever to control these transaction prices, right? The end sales price is one. The builder may buy a finished lot from a developer. That's another transaction cost. And then the final one is when the developer buys the raw piece of land from the landowner. So where does that extra money go? Well, it may be passed all the way down to the original landowner. The builder might not make any more profit, but the money goes someplace, right? Okay, so the fees and the regulation. The other thing that a city can adjust is the process. We can make the process better. We can streamline the process. We can remove steps from the process. We can deal with it in that way, and we can help our developer get a good project approved. Again, we don't think that that changes the price of the house. It sure makes it easier. It reduces the time. It should help, but it does not change the final price. We're fighting market forces here. There's some things that we can do as a city, but I don't want to create the illusion that permit fees or development fees or things like that are the controlling factor. We are proof of that example with a limited amount of regulation and a limited amount of fee structure, but our houses are just as expensive. We'll build probably 200 single-family homes in Hugo this year. They're going to start at $450,000. They'll go up to $650,000, and there'll be a handful that'll be well over $750,000. Okay? There's not a lot that we think that we know how to do to lower the cost of housing. The only other lever that we might be able to use is to provide a subsidy. Okay? If we provide a subsidy to a developer, which some cities might choose to do to create affordable housing, now we can start to put some strings along with that money. We can impose a cap on incomes for people that buy those homes, or a cap on prices or rents or things like that. So a few of the levers that we can pull on, but some of the levers that we can't, and the market forces is what we're going to tell you is the thing that drives it.
Thank you. Representative Munson has a question. And if, members, I'm so conscious of the time, so I'm hoping you keep your questions tight.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is really around the development cost of building the curb and gutter and streets and hooking up, that cost. And you mentioned something that the cost of housing in Hugo is the same in Centerville. In rural Minnesota, the cost of building houses is like really almost the same as in Edina, where the building the streets and the curb and gutter is the same wherever you are in the state. The land cost can change, but we have a problem. I have a lot of small towns in my district that just, 10 or 15 years ago or before the housing crisis decided to encourage building by paying for the development of the lots and then hoping to just have the builder pay for that when they buy the lots. And so there's three towns in my district that have whole developments built that one went bankrupt, but then two, the city had purchased themselves, and they're really burned from the housing crisis, and there's a fear of overbuilding again as we hear the demand for more housing. So have you changed your policies in cities or maybe neighboring towns around in the last 12 to 15 years since the housing crisis on how you partner with developers in allowing the development? Or I think you mentioned in Hugo that it seemed to be pretty conservative, but can you speak to that?
Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, we have been very flexible, and we have changed a number of our steps in our process to help manage development. The city has not undertaken the steps of paying for the infrastructure and then handing those improvements over to a developer. So from Hugo's standpoint, we're a city that does not receive any local government aid from the state. Any of the costs that the city would incur in construction of infrastructure would be paid directly by taxpayers and in our community. Not very likely that the taxpayers are going to want to support new development. We're not in a position in the metro area, at least not in Hugo, where that needs to occur. The development is going to happen without any infrastructure cost being incurred directly by city taxpayers.
Representative Veerman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the discussion and all the great information on city planning and all the moving parts to this process. Ms. Wolf, I wondered if you could address any specific complaints you got from the contractors developing all those fine houses and that large number in your community. Are there any specific complaints you hear again and again about regulations that are onerous to them?
Briefly.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative. The most common complaint that we hear is about the energy code and the potential for requiring sprinkling of single-family homes and how that drives cost. Other than that, our builders and developers understand what the building code is and they understand what the requirements are.
Okay, just also quickly, what about an affordability housing issue in Cambridge or Hugo? Could you address if you have an affordability issue for lower income? You talked about a lot of houses, Mr. Rivera, and the higher priced market. What about affordable housing? I consider 450 kind of high for affordable.
Is that for Mr. Baer?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so it's a really difficult thing to try to accomplish. We do have what I talked about are the single-family homes that will be built in Hugo this year. We'll likely have some townhomes that will be built and some apartment units that will be built. The apartment units will be affordable units, and we have Habitat for Humanity building a neighborhood in the community, and we're also doing a major rehab of a mobile home community in the city. So we do have some diversity in housing stock. Most of those projects come along with some kind of a program, which is funding from the federal government that helps move these things forward. There is not a lot of local community funding to support the affordable housing effort in Hugo.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, first of all, I'd like to thank City Administrator Wolf for being here today. It's always been a pleasure working with her. Generally, about 99% of the time, do we agree on everything?
Absolutely.
Once in a while, we have an issue come up. But I want to thank the City of Cambridge has done a fabulous job with the stuff they're doing with the housing. I know they have at least two apartment situations being built since the housing crash. They've done a lot of things. They've been working very well, getting things going again, and building is going on again, which is a good thing. But I think they're doing it in a much smarter way than they did before the crash. The only thing that I hear about in that area, and I guess I've never had an opportunity to ask you this question because when I see you, I always forget. One of the things that's required now, and it's the state is requiring it because of the aquifers and stuff, is the sediment ponds that are in the communities.
Right.
I'm just wondering if you could explain who is responsible for cleaning and the maintenance of these sediment ponds, because I've had a few people actually talk to me because they've gone from a sediment pond and some of them are actually turning into swamps with cattails and everything else. And
two wetlands. No.
Madam
Chair, yeah, Representative Johnson, unfortunately the answer is it depends. But 90% of the stormwater retention ponds are deeded over to the city at the time of development. And then it is the city's responsibility to clean that, maintain it, and we try to do that every winter, and we have a schedule. But if it stays private, like on a condominium association where they're a common interest community and they retain responsibility for that, then it is their responsibility to care and maintain.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Gow, we heard from Assistant Commissioner McClellan. What is the league's position on having state building codes versus 852 city ordinance codes?
Madam Chair, Representative, the state building code is meant to be applied statewide, and so that is something that was, as the Assistant Commissioner had mentioned, is something that it was agreed upon years ago. So for the state building code and for those safety codes, that is something that is statewide. When we're talking about, and there are a number of different ones, like you mentioned, plumbing, electrical, things like that.
Representative Fisher, and then we're moving on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm to our testifiers, first of all, thank you for being here. One of the questions I have is what's happening with climate change. And anecdotally, I've heard from some cities that, example, on stormwater requirements, what they used to require for developers and what they require now, because of the intensity of the storms that we're seeing now, they're having to require much more. What is happening out on the landscape there?
Absolutely. I can give you, Madam Chair and Representative, I can give you one specific example. The Parkwood development, part of it went into tax forfeiture. It had already been graded. All stormwater ponds have been done for that platted development. The new MS4 requirements came, and they had to increase the size of all of their retention ponds because it no longer fit the footprint under the new stormwater rules. So it does create issues, especially for developments that take a while to come to fruition.
Thank you very much. You've also given us some good handouts for the future, and we'll now hear perspective of the architects with Eric West, president of the AIA Board of Directors. I had the good fortune to be with them on Friday night and to hear from them, so we're happy to have you here. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and thank you for coming on Friday evening, Madam Chair. My name is Eric West, and as you said, I'm an architect and current president of the American Institute of Architects in Minnesota, or AIA Minnesota. AIA Minnesota is a professional organization founded in 1892, representing more than 2,300 architects across the state of Minnesota. We also have a national organization representing more than 83,000 members across the country. First, we want to applaud you for your efforts to address affordability as it relates to housing. Your goals are consistent with our mission as well, which is to advance the vital profession, vibrant communities, and architecture that endures. And our goal is not only to be a resource for policymakers for architecture-specific questions, but to be a resource and advocate for a better built environment, extending to issues like housing, energy, transit, community planning, and beyond. And that's why I'm here today, to provide input on the role of regulation on the built environment and related cost impacts. It's clear other testifiers have identified that there are many types of regulations that impact the cost of the building, each with a specific purpose. We want to clarify today a little bit the difference between zoning and zoning ordinances and the building code. Both are intended to create a better, healthier, and safer built environment, but they are different. Building codes are more directly related to health, safety, and well-being. An example might be safe wiring in your home or a code-compliant guardrail on your deck that keeps children and adults from falling off their deck in their home or something to that effect. Zoning also addresses health, safety, and welfare, but it more typically is related to issues of building size, general conformity to what is deemed appropriate by a certain community, and those vary community to community. Like the capital area we're in today has a very different zoning ordinance than the city of Elmo or others, given its unique function, and it has its own set of zoning standards that are specific to this context. Mr. McClellan provided a lot more insight, and I'll just give a general overview and similar to what he said, but the code process starts at the national level. The national standards are developed by experts in their field, including architects, engineers, builders, and building officials. The standards are debated at the national level to assure that safety is achieved, but always within a framework of reasonable cost effectiveness. Costs and benefit are discussed with any proposed amendment. Once the national codes are established, a similar group of statewide architects, engineers, builders, and building officials debate those at a local level and determine what's appropriate here and make amendments to those national codes and then make them active locally. Zoning can start with a similar standard, but is usually crafted at the local level, specific manner reflecting the needs of the locality. Like codes, zoning have an impact on costs, and usually those cost implications are debated at the local level in a public forum, and builders, architects, and public members are a part of that discussion. Because this is a housing committee, we wanted to touch on a specific issue that often comes up when we're discussing codes and housing, and those relate to energy. Current energy codes require new buildings to have more insulation and to be built to a higher standard than they were in the past. Admittedly, some of those new requirements can have some additional upfront costs. That said, a lot of study has gone into the efficacy of those requirements and comparing the cost to the long-term benefits to the homeowner or tenant and to the larger community. That small investment today comes with a payback in the long term. The cost of inefficient house represents real added cost to the energy cost of the homeowner for the long term. Couple those ongoing costs over the life of the building with the cost on the environment, and the incremental investment seems well worth the initial cost. We recognize that we need to look at all avenues when building a comprehensive plan to attack the affordable housing crisis. And while we don't believe that making wholesale changes to codes will have the cost-saving impact that some would like to, We want to help participate in discussions around any proposal that tries to address Minnesota's affordable housing needs. Affordable housing is critical needs that so many Minnesotans are looking for right now. While there's no one thing we think that you can do to solve the problem, if we all work together, we can advance policies that will make a real difference for many of our citizens. Again, thank you for your efforts, and AIA Minnesota is ready and willing to offer our time, interest, and passion to assist in designing a better Minnesota for all.
I love those last two pieces of advice you gave us. There's no one thing, and we all need to work together. Representative Pearson has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, all of this is wonderful, and I applaud, you know, the energy efficiencies. These are laudable things. We certainly want to move towards that. I guess my question and concern deals with real-life stories of, as a realtor, working with clients and having them consider new construction. And, you know, if you work with a client long enough, sometimes, you know, they're just starting to explore and might take a couple of years. And over the last few years, to see the costs, of course, material costs, everything else has gone up. But then when radon mitigation systems are required rather than only put in when there's, higher levels detected, or these energy efficiency standards going up and increasing the costs of everything from the window package to the HVAC system to the insulation, suddenly my client, who, you know, is really excited to maybe invest in their very first new construction home, is priced out of the market for that, and then turns around and looks back at the existing home stock, and the existing home stock is not as energy efficient, it's not as well insulated, and all of these things. And so for me, I'm kind of in this, because I'm also a historical preservationist. I really like existing home stock, but some of it isn't that architecturally interesting or preservable or that important to me. So it's kind of this dynamic. And you know, we talk in the legislature a lot about not being able to dynamically score things. And I'm concerned that we're so focused on making these new homes so energy efficient that we forget that by making them so expensive, there are a lot of people that can't build them. We constantly talk about the fact that the house cost in Hugo is $450,000. There's a lot of factors that are going into that. This is certainly one of them. And the fact that people can't build new construction and now are going back into the existing home stock, we've kind of dynamically scored those people out of that stock and not necessarily accomplished our goal, which is to have more energy-efficient homes out there. So I guess I just want to push back a little bit and ask the question, are we really considering the full impacts of setting these standards so high that we're now forcing people to stay in existing homes that, you know, probably wouldn't come close to meeting these standards that we're setting?
Mr. West, I don't know if you have a response to...
I'll try and keep a brief response to that. And I think you identified that there's a whole host of issues that are impacting that $450,000. And I think the energy component of that, while it has cost, I think if you did a real detailed analysis of what percentage that represents of the delta in cost, I think you would find it smaller than you would otherwise think as a percentage of all those other costs. And as somebody who lives in a 1940s home in South Minneapolis that is not energy efficient, I can tell you I pay for that on a monthly basis over and over, not just in terms of dollars and cents, but thermal comfort and, you know, all those other things. And my house, I wish it was a lot cheaper than it was when I built it, but where it is, it's an expensive home as well. So myriad of issues that go into it, and that's what makes what you're doing so complex, but also so valuable to all the citizens to look at all the different ways from zoning ordinances and other regulations down to the code, but I just ask that you do that with some level of detail.
Thank you very much. We appreciate having you here, and we're going to move on to the home builders and developers, and if all four could come forward, and we'll have two at a time at the table so we move as quickly as possible through. Mr. Noble, Mr. Paradise, Mr. Erickson, and Duffy. And is it Mr. Noble and Mr. Paradise first? Welcome to the committee. Mr. Noble.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Steve Noble. I'm the president of the BAM, the Build Association of Minnesota. I'm also a planning board member of a local city, and I've also been a past member or chair of our Habitat for Humanity. So I'm familiar with some of the things that have been discussed. I'm also a land developer and a builder for 25 years.
Please go ahead.
Okay. We were discussing affordable housing, and basically it comes down to, I've done some research on my own from what we've done locally, and we're looking at, it's not, like it was stated earlier, it's not just one thing, it's many things that's causing the unaffordable housing. We used to build a split level in the St. Cloud area for $120,000, $130,000. That same home today, and that was maybe 7-8 years ago. That same home today is about $240,000 to $270,000, exact same home. That's how much has come up. And the main reason is, like I say, it's not just one thing, but it's a multitude of things. So it's land development, the cost that the cities require us to put in for developing, and also is the cost of the energy code and some of the building codes that we're forced now to do that we didn't have to do before. So example, we had a discussion, it was brought up that we have radon. So radon is not in every home, but every home in new construction we have to put radon in. That cost is about $2,000 to $3,000 in cost to the home. Where local stock existing homes, if they have a radon issue, it's about a $500 fix where they put basically a hole in the ground and they put a fan on it and it pipes it up and you're good to go. But new construction, we have to put rock, poly, we have to seal every hole that's coming through the concrete. It's overdone for a house for something that we don't know if even exists. So that's money thrown away for, I'd say, 80% of the homes that we built. That could be fixed with the $500 fix if we found the problem afterwards. That's one example. Another example is the energy efficiency. We now went from our, used to be R30, now we're R40 plus for our, R is the rating we have for how much insulation or R value for a roof. So we're now up to R40 plus on how much insulation we have on a roof. We've taken existing homes from 1940s, 1950s, even earlier than the 1980s. Not even close to that. So we're forcing people to purchase a home that's up subpar to what we're building today because they can't afford it. So only the rich people right now can afford homes, and people who would have, like the police officers or fire department people, they can't afford that home anymore because we're overbuilding them. We're making them too energy efficient. And efficiency is great, but at what cost?
Mr. Paradise.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representatives. I'm Mike Paradise. I'm from Rochester. I'm a home builder down there, one of the larger home builders in southern Minnesota. In 2018, we closed about 140 homes. Our average sales price was about $260,000. So the bulk of the work we've done over the years has been more in the affordable arena. I've been in this industry. This is the start of my 40th year. I'm a past president of the Builders Association of Minnesota. They pulled me out of retirement to come here and talk to you. But I am concerned about what's going on pricing-wise. Rochester permits, single-family permits, last year are down 20%, which is shocking in a community that has the growth that we have. What I attribute that to is the fact that we're pricing our homes faster than our wages or our buyers can afford. So when you look at what was built last year, the bulk of it was some upper-end housing. I mean, we had some testimony here from some other cities where 450 was the norm, and it's somewhat similar in Rochester also. The cost of development and the cost of housing, part of that is due to a lot of these, well, it's all due to rising costs and fees, but there was some testimony earlier that the fees don't change the price. I think there is some truth to that. But the one thing that the fees do is they change the product that we build. So if the fees end up costing us, our lot production ends up costing us $50,000, $60,000 to bring the lots in, it's hard to actually build a product that's going to hit more of that affordable range. So the fees are forcing us to build product that's more expensive because as a builder, we of course have to build what we can, you know, what the market's going to drive us to do. So part of that is creating communities that probably are more cost effective. Some of that's some new thinking, some new ideas. It means higher density. With higher density and new ideas comes all kinds of roadblocks. One of the biggest one, of course, being neighbors. If we go into a neighborhood and say we want higher density because we want more affordable housing, there's an incredible pushback. Unfortunately, even our leaders have pushback from those neighbors that make it tougher and tougher to approve some of the product that we're trying to bring in. I think we do need to change our product, and that also requires some risk on behalf of the developer and builder. It's incredibly expensive today to bring this product to market, and it's a lot of risk. And those of us that have been around for a while still have the scars from the last downturn. So it's, you know, as a matter of fact, it's a lot tougher to bring in new ideas. I think that's maybe where the state and the local communities can help us by generating some new areas in town that might be a higher density product or a different type of product. And I think that's going to be important to solving this issue. Codes, I wanted to talk about those briefly. I'm very familiar with DLI. I've spent a lot of time on there. I'm the Construction Codes Advisory Council building representative. I also sat on some of their technical advisory groups as we wrote the code. I have been involved for quite a few years. As a matter of fact, I was involved in one of the first energy code that caused a lot of the initial issues, and of course we've had more on this last one. They are driving, unfortunately, anything to do with codes. If anybody's going to work on them, there's always a way to make them a little more stringent and a little better at a little more cost. And if we set ourselves to the task of rewriting a code every so many years, you rarely see anything come through the code process that says, we're going to make it our mission to lower the cost. It's typically evaluating what can we add and what is the cost associated with it. Maybe we need to step back and say, let's mandate some savings. Next time we go through the code cycle, let's try not to slow the increase, but let's go through it and see if we can mandate some savings. It's an incredibly complicated process, and it's hard as a builder to sit here and say, that code isn't needed. We shouldn't do that. I mean, it's fall protection rate on all those. It's hard to sit here and say, take them out. You know, it's going to be very difficult to look at the entire code and pick and choose what went into it because the creation of the code is a product of years and years of working on the code. So it's hard to do that. Energy code, that's always a tough one, and this last energy code cycle did produce some things that I think were unnecessary. Unfortunately, we even see more push to make our houses more and more energy efficient. And just really briefly, all of the homes that we do, we do board oil tests on them. We actually model them. We do an energy modeling on them. So it gives us an approximate cost on what the heating and electrical is. Our average home, like I said, our average home price is in the 260s approximately. The average heating bill in those homes for a year is between $300 and $400. That's the average annual cost. The average annual cooling bill on those homes is somewhere between $60 and $90. So that immediately brings to the fact that if we try to save money by making it more and more energy efficient, there's not a lot to save. As a matter of fact, the average electrical appliance cost in these homes is normally over $500. We pay more for appliances and electricity than we do for heating and cooling. We pay about the same in service charges as we do on our heating bills. So to make them more and more energy efficient, we'd be better off probably banning the Xbox to save energy as opposed to some of the things. So it's very, very important that we really analyze the codes, the impact they're having on the housing and the end cost. Can cities provide, we had some great testimony here about the cities, and we deal with them every day. Bigelow Homes, which is the company I'm the president of, builds in 9 communities, one of them being Rochester and 33 different subdivisions. So providing the infrastructure for this is a huge cost, stormwater being one of the biggest one in the last years. It's probably pushed some of the greatest increases in some of our development. That's going to be a hard one to fight because you're not only dealing with state but federal requirements also.
And can you conclude quickly?
The cities, so if the cities could provide infrastructure, help with infrastructure, we just heard testimony that it doesn't change the price. The builders would typically charge the same price. I tend to probably agree with that. So if we do that, if we ask for that to create affordable housing, we need to put some sort of controls in place that would help to manage that to make sure that the end savings made it down to the final buyer. And different product, higher density is probably the least the last message I'm going to leave you with. Thank you.
And you're Mr. Erickson?
Yes.
Is Mr. Duffy in the room? I think maybe then we can keep all three at the table because I think our fourth member is not here. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Nick Erickson. I'm with Housing First Minnesota. I just want to thank you for this topic. It's quite timely. For those of us working in the housing affordability space, the momentum that this issue has gathered over the last 2-3 years is very encouraging. And before I begin, I just want to make a few statements on some of the testimony we've already heard today. Mr. McClellan is perhaps the shining example of what we can be doing looking forward on housing policy. The Department of Labor and Industry has made a commitment to affordability in this latest round of building codes, which will take place coming soon, and I think his department's focus on affordability has been great. But I think one thing that we've heard before is the notion that developers pay. It's home buyers that are paying this. We're wondering why can we not build a new home for less than $375,000 in the Twin Cities? It's because homeowners pay. It's the home buyers that are paying these fees. And, you know, I just wanted to quickly begin, and then I can stand for some questions. But really, our state's housing ecosystem is broken. We cannot deliver the affordable new homes that are so desperately needed. Governor Dayton's housing task force from last year says we need 300,000 new homes by 2030. Just building those new housing units isn't enough. We have to make sure that Minnesotans can afford to buy these new homes. And that's why we undertook a significant research project for the last 6 months. We just released, and I think members of the committee did get a copy. It's called Priced Out. And what our report shows is a sobering assessment of what's wrong with our state's housing market. We can no longer build affordable new homes at the entry-level price point. This is driving up the demand on existing homes, which is why we've seen the sharp rise in existing home prices. The lack of supply in existing homes is increasing rents. We need to address not just the lack of supply, but the lack of affordable supply of homes. I want to also say that there's no single rule, nor any single regulation that in and of itself is to blame for this. It's just a lack of awareness of the broader cumulative costs that all these housing policies have on the price of a home. Kind of looking at our research that we've undertaken, by nearly every measure here in Minnesota, a new home costs more than any other market here in the Midwest. Up to one-third of a home's price here in the Twin Cities could be attributable to housing policies. And we actually did look across the Twin Cities and across the Midwest. Home costs are not the same from city to city. They vary for a variety of reasons. And to show you how much they can vary, a new home in Lake Elmo, Minnesota is nearly $50,000 more than the exact same home built by the exact same builder in Hudson, Wisconsin. It's a distance of 10 miles. Looking at suburban Chicago, a new home here, same builder in suburban Chicago, can cost up to $80,000 more. It's a difference of 25%. And, you know, why is this? It's a variety of factors. And we think that there just needs to be a new approach on housing, which is why we've called for a Housing Affordability Commission. The gentleman from the Architects Association who spoke before talked about kind of, you know, a broad partnership, and that's what we're calling for. We're calling for home builders, developers, code experts, local government, regional government, state government to come together and address this critical issue. See if we cannot get to a point where we're building those affordable new homes today. I think a lot of you will be surprised that the median new home price is $417,000 here in the Twin Cities. It's a lot of money. But we really cannot build a new home for less than $375,000. And I think we need to take an honest assessment and look at why that is and see what policies we can come up with to make sure that the dream of home ownership is attainable for future generations. I can take some questions.
Representative Pearson, and then we have Pearson and Howard, and then we'll have to move on because we have one more speaker.
Mr. Paradise, you're not going to be very popular with my 13-year-old boys with the talk of banning the Xbox, but my question can actually be answered by any or all of you. You know, when we talked about the fees, specifically, Mr. Noble, you had talked about the fees having gone up in the last 7 to 8 years, basically doubling those fees. Were the cities that the communities you were working with in the past, would you say they were losing money back at that time, or what's the big driver for them that's changed, and do you see that, you know, maybe this was being artificially subsidized 7 to 8 years ago to the loss of the cities?
In some cases, it may or may not have been, but I would say I'm thinking most of them are trying to get back from what they lost when the economy, when a lot of the developments went under. And a lot of the cities and counties ended up taking back a lot of the property, and a lot of the cities helped fund some of those developments wisely or unwisely. And so a lot of the cities ended up taking the big hit on not getting paid for the improvements or some of these properties. I think it's some of that fear is what's driving most of the cost fees. So we have a development that we're doing in Sartell that we just did. We're on our second phase. And our first phase, our fees for, you add up all the city fees and everything else we had to do, it's about almost over a third or plus cost of the lot before we put any sewer and water. So our lots are about $90,000 the cost for it. And we bought the lot. The property is super cheap. It was actually a foreclosed piece of property, and we bought it for a steal. But just our fees and our costs for improvements makes them $90,000. And when we're looking at, I'm looking at a profit of about $10,000 a lot. That's not very much for how much risk we had to put in for that property. Most of those are fees and costs. So it's that NERP ponds that we have to put in. And there was discussion earlier about ponds, about cleaning them out and the city taking them over. I've been building and developing for over 30 years. I haven't seen yet one of our cities in our area clean one of those out.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for either Mr. Paradise or Mr. Noble. The focus of the hearing today has largely been on, you know, fees and regulation. I think it's an important discussion, but I'm wondering if you'd comment on, in terms of, as over the last decade or so, the issues in terms of workforce for folks building homes, or cost of materials, or other things that are driving up the cost that have been challenges that you've seen in particular in the last decade or so.
Mr. Paradise, I'm going to give you a minute.
Okay. So workforce, it is an issue. But remember, during the downturn, a lot of these contractors, subcontractors took no increase. As a matter of fact, some of them took decreases. Once the industry got back on its feet, in order to keep their help or get new help, they had to pay a better wage. So that's what's driving a lot of the cost on the workforce. Materials, there's always going to be an increase in materials year after year. Lumber's been all over the board, and I think that's something beyond our control. But our labor will continue to go up.
Thank you. Sorry, just one quick follow-up. There's been a lot of discussion of kind of the energy code issues, and something that you said, Mr. Paradise, in general was the need for just new ideas, and that struck a chord with me. I think at all levels of government, we need to have that sort of mindset, being open to new ideas and innovation. I do think that most Minnesotans want energy efficient homes, and we're definitely cognizant of the price and how that can be a challenge for folks. But I'm wondering if you'd comment on if there has been any sort of changes, or do you see a role for innovation to address some of those, to meet the demand for energy-efficient homes?
I think Mr. Erickson wants
to. Representative, I can tell you at Housing First, we are actually undertaking an innovation project right now. I have some of a wide variety of construction, home building professionals from the energy, from the home building, physical construction side, and anything having to do with kind of state policy. We are currently working on a concept, which is, if given the opportunity, could we build a home, as Mr. Noble said, it used to be 125,000, it's now 260. Could we change could we innovate some way with new materials, new construction practices, and can we build a new home today that is comparable to the home price of, or basically the existing home price? So here in the Twin Cities, it'd be about $275,000 is the median existing home price. Our median new is $417,000. So the challenge we've posed to our members is, can you build this home for $217,000? We're getting close, but we're also realizing that that's only half the challenge. We also need to see if we can get those lot prices down. So we have another group that is beginning on Friday, actually, to work through kind of some policies and community layouts to see what could we have as a next generation housing development and a next generation home. Of course, that's going to take partnership from our government partners to implement, but we are looking forward to having some type of innovative new home, new community design that we can bring to our government partners and say, let us build this. We need to be doing more affordable homes, and we hope to be sharing with you maybe next session or maybe later this year.
Representative Tice, this year is a very tight question. No comment, just question. Really fast.
Well, it's a bit of a comment, too.
We could save closing comments.
Okay.
So I just want to get our last speaker in before, we'll give you an opportunity for final comment. Thank you very much for being here. Tim Thompson, President, Housing Justice Center. Sorry to make you wait. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Tim Thompson. I'm president of the Housing Justice Center, which is a Twin Cities public interest law firm focused on preserving and expanding the supply of affordable housing, particularly affordable rental housing. In 2016, Minnesota Housing and the McKnight Foundation and other organizations were looking for new ideas on how to address the cost of affordable rental housing. So they sponsored an idea competition called Minnesota Challenge. Our organization submitted a proposal together with the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs focused on areas where local government practices affected cost. We were ended up selected as the winning proposal. We submitted a report identifying 11 different areas in which local government practices could have a positive or in some cases a negative impact on cost. I'm just going to mention two of those areas today. One, because it's the area that we found had the biggest impact, and the second one, because it's an area that I think maybe has a lot of promise for the future. The first area is supporting appropriate size and density of new affordable rental developments, and the same reasoning actually applies for market rate multifamily developments as well. The phenomenon that we are all familiar with is a proposal gets put forward, residents object to the size, density, height, number of units of the development. The city responds by cutting back the size. In some cases, that may be appropriate, but that really has the effect of driving up the per unit cost. And that's because you have a lot of fixed costs that developers spread over the number of units they have. And when you reduce the number of units, that increases the per unit cost considerably. So two quick examples. There was a townhouse development in a third ring suburb several years ago. The developer sought a very modest increase in zoning through a rezoning request. The city was initially supportive, and they were going to throw in some fee waivers in addition. Neighborhood opposition caused the city to back down. It refused to rezone. The developer had to go back to the drawing board, came back with a new proposal within the existing zoning after some time, and due to having to reduce the size of the project, losing the fee waivers, and the additional time, the per unit cost went from $216,000 per unit to over $300,000 per unit. In Minneapolis several years ago, an affordable rental housing proposal was put forward. It would have been four stories. The city, after facing a lot of opposition, reduced it to three stories. That added a cost of over $40,000 per unit. So obviously cities have a role in looking at the size, scale, and density of developments, but we have to realize that when you reduce it, that really drives up costs. The second area that I would mention is manufactured home park communities and modular housing. I think this is an area that we need to pay more attention to. We have not developed a new manufactured home park community in the state in decades. We generally have this image and are all familiar with a lot of manufactured home parks where the homes are very old. There may be a declining infrastructure. Although it's very affordable, it may not be ideal. But a new manufactured home park community would not have to be that way. We found in our study that you could assemble a very nice home. You could put it on the lot, set it up for not much more than $100,000 per unit. Compare that with the cost of a typical new affordable rental apartment, which is over $200,000 per unit. We think there's some real potential there. Similarly, with modular housing, factory-built housing, that's another new construction technique that we think has a lot of potential. One of the challenges is, in order to do these things, you need factories near the site, but there you can't build the factory to develop the housing until there's a market for it. So it's a kind of a chicken and egg problem, but if the state could figure out a way to nudge that forward, we think that's a real promising area. And I'll stop there.
Good, good. A couple of good new suggestions. And Representative Tice, you have a closing comment or response?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank everyone for coming here to testify today, especially my fellow colleagues, past Builder Association presidents. It's good to see you here. I think I want the, you know, I hope we all enjoy hearing about the different sides of the story, but I think our bigger message is, this is about affordable housing, homelessness, and it's just really hard to hear how a split-entry first-time homeowner home has gone from $120,000 to $150,000 to $260,000. That's what the problem is. We can't build housing for folks wanting to get into homes, and it's, you know, it's just really hard to hear where, you know, in some communities it's $300,000 to $400,000. I mean, that's not affordable for a lot of folks. I don't even want to buy a house $300,000 to $400,000. I'm at the time of my life where I want to spend less money and have a better, you know, a more accessible place to live. And it's getting to be where you can't find that type of housing. So we're talking about a lot of different housing, but, you know, my next home is going to be a patio home. And I'm going to spend probably $300,000. That's a lot of money for someone who has to start watching how much I'm spending. And that's, I think, the message that we as a committee want to say is, it is everybody all together looking at the whole big picture. It is looking at how do we keep costs down. And everybody's got a stake in it, especially Minnesota. We've got to find a way to get back from $260,000 for a first-time homeowner home to $150,000. We just need to find a way to do it. And we haven't even talked a whole lot about the senior population and what their demands are for homes, because they really are running out of opportunities for that as well. So I hope that you really get the spirit of this committee. It's not to point fingers and just to say that you're spending too much money. It's we have a problem and we need to fix it, and we need to work together to figure out what that looks like and to be innovative thinking as well and come up with some new ideas. So thank you all for coming here. It's been very, very interesting listening to you all, and I hope that we continue the conversation.
Representative Fisher, do you have a question for Mr. Thompson?
No, I don't.
Or just a closing comment?
Just closing if I could.
I'll just thank Mr. Thompson, because I think your concluding advice to us gives us new directions to think.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple things. I want to thank all the testifiers that were here. It's a big problem that we're facing, is trying to figure out how to keep things affordable. I think one of the things that was kind of missed in the discussion is the fact that part of the problem comes from stagnated wages for people over the number of years that we've had. And until we start taking a look at that, we're going to be challenged. The other part is trying to think of things very differently going forward. A lot of the concerns that were being put out there were by developers saying we've got all these fees, whether it's taking care of stormwater, which we know climate is impacting that, water supply, sewer fees. It's getting us to think differently is if a community has got everything right-sized now and development happens, is it fair for that community to pay for that development to occur? And that's going to be a big issue, I know, in the East Metro, is we have water supply problems. At the current population, they're fine. They can use groundwater, which is cheap.
But with the projected growth that the communities are going to have as the open land is developed, they're going to need surface water. We're probably taking a look at about $1 billion to build the surface water supply system that would service everywhere from Woodbury up to Hugo and beyond. The problem is who's going to pay for that? In the past, we've always taken a look as the people who are moving in are paying for that to get the savings that you need. And that means that we as citizens, whether it be the local communities themselves or the state, is going to have to start taking a look. How much of these costs do we start subsidizing to take care of the growth that we're going to need out there? And I think that's where some of the bigger problems, when you take a look at some of the bigger infrastructure costs that we're going to need to address. So it's going to require us to think differently. And then finally, for the local communities to realize that, what can we do to address density? You know, when you've got individuals on a block saying, I don't want to have a four-story building, I want a three-story building, how do you address that situation? Because it comes down to, in Maplewood, when we've looked at redevelopment, the more that you can have for density, the more affordable it is. And when you're doing redevelopment, you need that higher density to make it affordable. The question is, do the people who live in the community have the capacity and willingness to support those efforts? And if they don't, how do we as a state address that situation?
Thank you very much for being here today. We are adjourned.